Good evening. Good evening, everyone. My name is Matthias Matisse, and I'm an assistant professor here at SAIS in international political economy. So I want to warmly welcome you all to this event here tonight at SAIS. Around early 1970s, there was a very famous political economist that wrote a very well-noticed article. Her name was Susan Strange, and she wrote an article in International Organization saying international economics and international relations, a case of mutual neglect. And I like to think that what we do at SAIS is exactly the opposite, right? That we try in our education to integrate our knowledge that you are forced to have of international economics with a solid knowledge of international relations. And I consider the mission of the Schwartz Globalization Initiative, as it is here at SAIS, as exactly doing this, as getting economists to talk to political scientists and also doing work that is policy relevant. So, starting this academic year, myself and Pravin Krishna, who's a colleague at the International Economics Department, a senior colleague, I should add, we're co-chairs of this forum, and it's our intention and our hope to kind of get a serious intellectual debate and a serious kind of scholarly integration of policymakers and people that are interested in international political economy. And so when Pravin and I were discussing who to get as part of this series, because we're going to have a lecture seminar series, a scholarly seminar for a smaller audience, but we also wanted to have big speakers, a distinguished lecture series for a broader audience, for the Washington policy community, for our students also and our faculty and the faculty of the surrounding universities here in Washington, we both immediately mentioned Jeffrey Frieden. And I can't think of anyone better tonight to start off this series on this distinguished lecture series on international political economy. I first heard of Jeff Frieden when I started my SAIS studies in Bologna in 2001. We had to go through the Frieden Lake Reader of International Political Economy, which is still one of the best collections of readings. And I think, as most people still are, we were forced to read his International Organization article of 91, Invested Interests. One of the first kind of rational choice statements of why European governments would agree to giving up so much of their sovereignty to the European Union based on their own interests, and that being a careful compromise of this. So Jeff Frieden has set the academic agenda in many areas of international political economy. Frieden got most of his education at Columbia University, where he got his BA and his PhD, and then spent his time basically split between the West Coast and the East Coast. He started out in UCLA and University of California, Los Angeles, where he taught until 1995, and then became a professor of government at Harvard University. Among his many, many publications, you know, Jeff Frieden is one of those people that has a short resume, which has about 7 pages. So I couldn't find the long resume, but I figured the short resume would do. So among his many books was Banking on the World, The Politics of American International Finance in 1987, Debt, Development and Democracy, Modern Political Economy in Latin America, which was published by Princeton University Press in 91, and also, and I think probably best known amongst a broader audience, was his excellent Global Capitalism, Its Fall and Rise in the 20th Century. I've asked him if he's going to change that, or if the publishers have asked him, Global Capitalism, Its Fall, Rise in the 20th Century, and Its Fall in the 21st Century, but he said he wasn't sure, but that the publishers did want him to do a second edition. So stay tuned on that one. But Jeff is here tonight to talk about his latest book, which is co-authored with Menzi Ching from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is called Lost Decades. Right? So the title of tonight's lecture is about the work that Jeff and Chin have done on debt crisis, on the current debt crisis. It's an excellent book. I was in New York last weekend, and I took the train there, and I know it takes quite a while to get even with the train, but still, I read the first half on the way there, the second half on the way back. Barry Eichengreen says, of all the books on the financial crisis out there, if you have to read one, this is it. And I agree with Barry Eichengreen. So it is my great honor to introduce to you tonight, as the first lecture of our Schwartz series, is Jeffrey Friedan. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Matthias. That's very, very generous, and it's a great privilege and a great honor to be here. I will try to, uncharacteristically for myself, be brief enough to allow for some discussion back and forth. Things are changing rapidly, as those of you who are following the news know. There have been some innovations in European policy in the last day or two that are probably worth talking about. But what I want to do really is start with a broader overview of the crisis that we find ourselves in. It is no mystery. We all know that both the United States and Western Europe face some really major economic difficulties. The recession that began at the end of 2007 was the deepest economic downturn since the 1930s. It was the longest economic downturn since the 1930s. Not only was it the deepest and longest, but the recovery has been extraordinarily slow and in many ways very, very troubling. Of course, in Europe, the recovery lasted very briefly and led to a second dip of a double-dip recession, which Europe still finds itself mired in. But even in the United States, the recovery has been extraordinarily slow. And unusually severe. If we were to compare the aftermath of the current crisis to recessions that have taken place in the U.S. since the 1930s, leaving aside the Great Depression and the recession of 1937, recessions in the U.S. really over the past 75 years, we are about at least 3 years behind. That is, in a typical recession in the past 75 years, within between 6 and 9 months of the beginning of the recession, employment had regained its pre-recession level. It's now 5 years after the recession began. Unemployment is above 8%, and the estimates are that it may take 3 more years for it to get back down to pre-recession levels. Right? In the typical recession, GDP returns to its pre-recession level within a year to 15 months. We just barely now, 5 years later, have gotten back to pre-recession GDP. In the typical recession between the late 30s and today, the average unemployment spell is about 3 months. That is, a worker laid off takes about 3 months to find a new job. In this recession, the typical unemployment spell right now is 10 months, and it has continued to rise. That is, the typical worker laid off has taken 10 months and more to find the new job. So this doesn't feel like your typical cyclical recession, such as we've come to know over the past 75 years, both in the U.S. and in Western Europe. And what I want to focus on is why it doesn't feel like your typical cyclical recession. And that is because it's not. It's something very different. It's a debt crisis. It's a classic debt crisis, such as we've come to know in countries like Brazil or Thailand or Russia or Turkey or the U.S. in the 1890s or Germany in the 1930s, countries that engage in what we call in the business a capital flow cycle. That is, a bunch of money floods into a country, gives rise to a boom, sometimes a bubble, eventually leads to a crisis. Right? In the U.S., that is exactly what we experienced. Between 2001 and 2007, the United States borrowed between $500 billion and $1 trillion a year from the rest of the world, adding up to about $5 trillion. Right? Some of that was borrowing by the federal government to finance budget deficits. Most of it was borrowing by American households to finance current consumption, whether in the form of credit card debt, car loans, or household finance, housing finance. Right? So what we experienced in the U.S. was a debt finance consumption boom. In other words, we borrowed very heavily for those 7 years. It increased our consumption, and we were left with the debt. There's an ironic aspect to this, and in Washington it's only appropriate to mention it, because for decades, maybe even scores of years, maybe even a century, Americans and others, the IMF, the World Bank, have run around the world telling developing countries, whatever you do, don't run budget deficits that you can't justify economically. And whatever you do, don't borrow, especially internationally, to finance current consumption. If you do that, you'll get yourself into terrible trouble. And it turned out that was really good advice, because that's exactly what we did, and that's exactly what's gotten us into the problems that we face today. So how did we do it? How did we find ourselves in conditions, we and the Europeans, find ourselves in conditions that previously, really for almost 100 years, had only characterized poor countries? You have to start somewhere. Let's start in the year 2000. Those of you, Matthias was very gently and kindly reminding me that I got my BA before he was born. But some of you will remember the year 2000. In the year 2000, the country faced a macroeconomic conditions that were puzzling and to some people troubling. And that was that the U.S., the federal government, was running a budget surplus of about $225 billion, right? This was the result of some very difficult years, of a difficult period in the 1990s. Of course, we started the 1990s, as through all the 1980s, with substantial deficits. 1993, Clinton comes into office, and for the rest of the 1990s, with great difficulty, in a bipartisan context, remember, you have a Republican Congress and a Democratic president, the budget deficit was eliminated and turned into a $225 billion surplus. Right? In fact, the CBO at that point estimated that simply projecting current trends out, by the year 2006, the U.S., the federal government, would have retired the entirety of its debt for the first time since 1836. Right? And would have made a substantial dent and come close to dealing with the longer-term problems of Social Security and Medicare. Right? Now, why was this a problem? It was seen as a problem in some quarters, for two reasons. The first reason was, and this was a reason that exercised Alan Greenspan, the first reason is that if the government starts running a surplus and retires all of its debt, right, then it has money, it has to invest it somewhere. So the government, if a government runs a surplus, retires its debt, it then has to invest in private assets. And Greenspan was concerned, and I think this is a very legitimate concern, I'm not saying this was invented, was concerned that this continued surplus meant that the U.S. government would be buying bonds, equities, other private assets, and he thought that there were problems associated with this, although there were ways of setting up trust funds and things along those lines. Another concern was expressed by the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, and that was the Federal Reserve, exercises monetary policy by buying and selling, by dealing in treasury securities. And with surpluses projected out for the foreseeable future, there would have been a shortage of treasury securities. And so the Fed actually set up some studies to try to figure out what to do, and they came up with the conclusion that what they would have to do is operate open market operations, monetary policy, using things like World Bank bonds, which are poor substitutes for treasury securities. So those were the macroeconomic problems that exercised people about the federal budget in early 2001. Well, as we know, George Bush solved those problems with a stroke of a pen in 2001 and again in 2003, when the tax cuts took the federal government from a $225 billion surplus to a $400 billion deficit in the space of a couple of years. That is, by the way, the largest single turnaround in the U.S. government's fiscal position in all peacetime history. Okay, so this is a very, very rapid change in the fiscal stance of the government. Now, why does this matter to the story that I'm telling? Because the majority of this fiscal turnaround, the majority of this deficit finance, was borrowed from abroad. Right? It also had a substantial effect on domestic macroeconomic conditions. You may recall that 2001 there was a brief recession associated with the end of the dot-com boom, and then of course there was 9/11, which led to a lot of uncertainty about economic conditions. So the federal government is trying to stimulate the economy with tax cuts. These tax cuts lead to a big deficit. The deficit is financed abroad. So foreign borrowing is being used to stimulate the economy and increase spending. A second component part of this, though, is monetary policy. starting in 2001, the Fed drove interest rates down, eventually down to about 1%, right, at a time when inflation was between 2 and 3%. So from middle, late 2001, really towards the end of 2004, interest rates, the Fed's funds rate, stayed at or near 1%, while inflation was above that. So you had effectively negative real interest rates. There's been a lot of controversy over this, as some of you will know. We can discuss whether it was justified or not. But the reality is that for those 3 or 4 years, you had negative real interest rates, meaning that there are tremendous incentives to borrow. So fiscal policy is injecting a lot of money into the economy, and spending is rising. And monetary policy is giving American households a tremendous incentive to borrow. And so they did. They borrowed, again, hundreds of billions of dollars from the rest of the world, in order to finance an increase in consumption. Okay. Now, the path that the U.S. went down in this 2001 to 2007 period is, for those of you who follow financial crises or borrowing experiences more generally, a very well-worn path. It's well known. Many of you will know the excellent book by my colleague Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart called This Time is Different. The subtitle is 800 Years of Financial Folly, and although the title is This Time is Different, the meaning is it's never different. Right? That is that these borrowing experiences have some extraordinary regularities, and that applies to the American experience as well. When capital flows into a country, it has to be spent on something. Capital inflow, such as that of the size that we experience in the U.S., has to be spent on something, and typically it gets spent on two different kinds of things. The first thing it can get spent on are things, hard goods, things that can enter easily into trade, into world trade, tradable goods and services. Cars, steel, petrochemicals, things that are traded across borders, right? And so as spending increased and as our borrowing from the rest of the world increased, a substantial amount of what we borrowed went into an increase in spending on tradables and a big increase in imports. So our imports rose from $1.3 trillion to $2.4 trillion over the space of 2 or 3 years, and our trade deficit doubled. Again, typically in line with the pattern associated with the foreign borrowing experience. But only some of the increased spending is spent on these traded goods. Most of the rest is spent on goods and services that have to be consumed where they're produced. Right? Things like haircuts or restaurant food or leisure activities or housing. Housing is the single biggest component of the consumption basket of the American consumer. 1/3 of all of consumer spending in the U.S., or the household consumer spending in the U.S., is in shelter. Right? So as American households are borrowing, much of the spending goes into these non-traded goods and services, like housing. Well, in the tradables case, in things like steel and automobiles, when there's an increase in demand for them, what you get is a big increase in imports. In the non-tradables case, when people increase the demand for haircuts, or for restaurant food, or for housing, supply doesn't respond that quickly, and prices go up. And so what we experience in virtually every, I can't think of any exceptions, there may be, but in virtually every instance of a substantial capital inflow, borrowing from the rest of the world, is an increase in the trade deficit and an increase in the price of non-traded goods and services, especially housing. And the U.S. is no different. Between 2002 and 2007, as we realized this big increase in the trade deficit, the price of traded goods went down, durable goods, went down 13%. And the price of services, including housing, went up 25%. It wasn't just housing. It was all non-traded services, right? So what we experience is what we would expect to experience as the country is flooded with $5 trillion in new money from the rest of the world. Trade deficit and a big increase in the price of non-tradables. Concentrated in the main non-tradable, which is housing. So, in other words, we get a debt-financed expansion of consumption. That expansion leads to a boom. That boom leads to a bubble. And eventually that bubble bursts. That's the American story. Now, because Matthias wanted me to I'm not going to blame Matthias, but because I think it, because it makes sense, and Matthias sensibly asked me to, I'm, instead of just sticking with the American story, I want to open it up a little bit and talk some about the European experience, which parallels the American, but has some substantial differences, right? Because there's another set of classic debt crises brewing at much the same time. As in the U.S., the European crisis involves a mix of government borrowing and household borrowing. Right? But actually, the mix in Europe in the run-up to the debt crisis is much more heavily oriented towards household borrowing. This is something that is important to emphasize because much of the discussion of the European crisis focuses on government budget deficits and on fiscal policy. The reality is that the run-up to the crisis was the result almost exclusively of borrowing by private households from private financial institutions. It is true that Greece ran substantial, the Greek government ran substantial budget deficits in the run-up to the crisis. Portugal ran smaller ones. But Portugal and Greece really aren't that big. The real problem in the European crisis today is Spain, and the entirety of the Spanish foreign debt is private, was private. It was built up by private households. In fact, the Spanish government was running surpluses throughout this period. So what happened in Europe? Europe, again, perhaps by coincidence, the clock starts around 2000 when the euro is created. And when the euro is created, it was well known at the time, and Eric can attest to this because Eric and I participated in a project on the political economy of European monetary integration starting in 1991 or 92. And at the time, so this is not something that was invented in 2007 or 2008, but at the time, talking about the process of European monetary integration, there were three issues, some would say three flaws, three gaps, that were incomplete or that were known to be likely to cause difficulties in the creation of the Eurozone. The first was the application of a common monetary policy to a series of countries with very different macroeconomic conditions. Right? Germany is very different from Greece, Spain is very different from Finland, and yet they're going to have a common monetary policy. I'll come back to all of these and show how they work together. The second was that it was clear that once the euro was created, there would very rapidly develop a common financial system. That is, a common currency leads to a common financial system where banks and other financial institutions are lending across borders without regard to the borders because it's all in the same currency. And yet, financial regulation remained entirely in the hands of national authorities. So you had a common financial system with highly fragmented and very, very different financial regulations. And the problem there is that gives rise to the possibility for financial institutions to find ways to evade their own national regulators and take advantage of gaps in other people's regulations. It also leaves very ambiguous who's responsible for the financial flows that are taking place within this monetary union. And the third problem is one that we've come to know in the U.S. as well, usually under the rubric of moral hazard, but the notion that in a currency union, it would be very difficult for the members of the currency union to be able to commit not to bail out a country in trouble. And the example, I can quote this because this is an example that a lot of people gave, and in fact, I gave it in things written long before the crisis happened, is imagine there's a financial crisis in Spain. A financial crisis in Spain is a Spanish problem, but it's also a problem for the Eurozone as a whole because it could threaten financial conditions in the Eurozone, and it could threaten the position of the euro as a currency. So there's a strong incentive for the other members of the Eurozone to step in and bail out Spain if it gets into trouble. Knowing that the other members of the Eurozone will step in to bail out Spain if it gets into difficulties, Spain has less incentive to be careful about what it borrows. Right? And so the absence of a credible no bailout commitment, the term used, was the third flaw or gap or problem with the development of the Eurozone. So what happened in the event? In the event, the euro is created, 1999, 2000, and for sake of simplicity, let's simply think of the eurozone as being divided into two groups of countries. You have Northern Europe, which is growing very slowly or stagnant, or not growing at all, and has very low inflation. And then you have Southern Europe, or what I would prefer to think of as peripheral Europe, because Ireland is not southern. And it also applies to many countries in Central and Eastern Europe in the former Soviet Union, like Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. So peripheral Europe, which is growing quite rapidly. Right? The slow-growing countries, prices are essentially not increasing at all, and the economic activity is not increasing at all. In the rapidly growing countries, because they're growing rapidly, prices are rising. They're not rising a lot, but they're maybe rising 2, 3, 4% a year. So you have two regions, just to simplify, one with zero inflation, one with, say, 3 or 4% inflation. And the ECB has to set monetary policy for both regions. Right? It can't set one for one region and one for the other. And so it tries to find an average. And just to take to be simple about it, let's say it chooses 2%. Well, 2% is a perfectly reasonable monetary policy for Germany, with no inflation effectively. But what it means in Spain, where inflation is 4%, is, as in the US, that real interest rates are negative. And so it gives a tremendous incentive for people in the periphery to borrow very heavily, which they do. Take advantage of the opportunities given by negative real interest rates to borrow very heavily. This then becomes self-reinforcing. Because as Spanish households borrow to buy homes, cars, whatever it might be, to consume more, prices start rising in Spain. The ECB is not going to adjust European monetary policy just because prices are rising in Spain. So interest rates, real interest rates in Spain, get lower and lower, and the incentives to borrow rise even further, which is why in Europe you get a bubble, as we did in the U.S., in the peripheral European countries, a housing bubble and a bubble in other activities as well. This then creates a problem for these fragmented financial regulators. The Spanish financial regulators, who actually had some of the most stringent financial regulations in all of Europe, and in fact, of all the OECD, are looking and saying, oh my goodness, what's happening? Hundreds of billions of dollars are flooding into the country. We can't control it. We can't possibly keep track of what's going on. The banks are putting tremendous pressure on us to allow them to lend more because they're being able to borrow as much as they want from Northern Europe. And so banks, financial institutions take advantage of this regulatory fragmentation to find opportunities to make riskier loans than might have been prudent were they a single regulator. Meanwhile, you have the moral hazard problem, which is that some countries, some borrowers, some financial institutions recognize that if trouble does erupt, they'll probably get bailed out. So that's the European aspect of the crisis, and I think it's important to lay out because although it is in many ways similar to the U.S., there are some differences as well, and that gets us to what kinds of measures might be undertaken to deal with the European crisis. I should note something broader, and that is that in some sense, in the broadest possible sense, what I'm describing is a process that takes place globally over the decade that runs from about 2000 to 2010. In some ways, we can think of the world as being divided into two big groups of countries in that decade. One big group of countries is growing by borrowing from the rest of the world to finance current consumption. And that's the U.S., the U.K., peripheral Europe. Right? These are countries whose engine of economic growth is debt finance consumption. And then there's another big group of countries who are growing because they are exporting to the consumers, because they've thrown all their resources into producing goods for export that they can sell to the U.S. and the U.K. and peripheral Europe. And those countries are China, East Asia, Germany, other countries in Northern Europe, right? Of course, the oil producers as well. But the most important ones really are the East Asians and the Northern Europeans. So what ties together these two stories is this division of the world between the deficit countries, who are growing because they're borrowing from the rest of the world to consume, and the surplus countries, who are growing because they're exporting to the rest of the world so that they can consume. And as it turned out, that process was stable for 7 or 8 years, but was not stable over the long run and eventually came to an end, right? I'm going to forego some of the other issues because I want to now, which we can come back to in discussion, I want to leave time for that, plenty of time for that. I want to talk about the implications of the crisis for its aftermath and why it is that things seem to be so difficult today. Why is this crisis different from all other crises? Because, in a sense, what we observe, as I started off by saying, is that the recovery has been extraordinarily slow. The Europeans have not recovered. The unemployment rate, the rate of GDP growth, all of these things look strikingly different from recoveries from previous recessions. Right? And the reason is, as I say, that this is a debt crisis. And a debt crisis is different. It's different for economic reasons, and it's different for political reasons. On the economic front, well, first, we can identify the underlying economic problem associated with turning around a country that has come to rely on borrowing from the rest of the world and all of a sudden can't do that. When you borrow from the rest of the world, essentially what you're doing is you are borrowing so that you can consume more than you produce, you're borrowing so that you can import more than you export, and you're borrowing so that your government can spend more than it takes in, or some combination of those three. When that stops, which it has for some of the European countries, all three of those relationships have to turn around. Now you have to produce more than you consume, so you can generate the resources to service your debt. You have to save more than you invest, so you can send capital abroad. You have to export more than you import, so you can generate the foreign currency to pay off your debtors. And your government has to take in more than it spends in current expenditures so that it can service its debt. In other words, you need to tighten your belt. This is the famous austerity that everyone's talking about. So that's sort of the backdrop. But let me talk more specifically about the economic and political difficulties associated with a debt crisis of this type. First, economically. A lot of you have heard about the debt overhang as being the central problem associated with this crisis. But what does that mean? What it means is that both creditors and debtors in the current circumstances are left with an accumulation of debts, right, that restrain and constrain their ability to undertake activities that would expand expand the economy. We can start with the debtor side. The debt overhang from the debtor side, you can think of a household. I think I was talking with Matthias earlier, and I'll give you some numbers, and maybe they're illustrative, right? So the average American household, 2007, right? These numbers are roughly right. I'm rounding them a little bit. This average household is a couple in early 50s with kids out of the house. They've got $250,000 in retirement savings, and they've got a home worth $250,000. They've got a retirement target. That is, why do they have these savings? Because they anticipate that within 15 years they're going to retire, and they want to be able to live at a certain level in retirement. Right? They wake up one morning a year later. Not quite one morning, but a year later, when they look at their accounts, what they find is that their retirement savings are now worth $150,000, not $250,000. And their house is worth $150,000, not $250,000. Right. In other words, their assets have taken a tremendous hit. They still have the same retirement target. They still want to be able to move to Florida, sell the house, get a condo in Florida, live in a reasonable lifestyle. So how are they going to restore the standard of living or the savings that they've now lost? They have to cut back on consumption dramatically. Right? And so in this context, and this is just an illustration of how the debt overhang affects consumers, in this context what it does is make it imperative that consumers whose assets are worth much less, right, but whose debts have stayed the same, have to save much more and consume much less. So that puts major constraints on spending. From the standpoint of financial institutions, you have American financial institutions with trillions of dollars in debts, some of which they know are bad, and others of which they think might be bad. Right? PwC just estimated that $1 trillion in current euro debts should be written off. Not just that they're troubled, not just that they might run into difficulties, but that they will not be repaid. $1 trillion. That's a lot of money. Right? So if you're a financial institution and you know that a substantial portion of your book is either bad or likely to be bad, you are tightly constrained in what you're going to do. You are certainly not going to search out riskier borrowers. In fact, what you're most likely to do is, to the extent possible, put all your money into riskless assets like treasury securities. And that, again, constrains lending and therefore spending. So the debt, from an economic standpoint, the debt overhang is the principal source of the slow recovery from debt crises. Some of you will know from the Rogoff and Reinhardt book and from some articles that they've published since then, that when they, simply statistically, this is not really an analytical argument on their part, it's simply a statistical relationship, that when they look at debt crises of these type, what they typically find is that recovery takes somewhere between 5 and 10 years, right, which is two to five times longer than recovery from a normal recession. Okay, so that's the economic front. But I am a political scientist, and I want to spend some time focusing on the reason why a debt crisis is different politically. Recessions are no political picnic. No one likes unemployment to rise. No one likes the economy to stop growing. But again, debt crises are different. And the reason debt crises are different is that debt crises raise inevitably the question about the distribution of the burden of adjustment. I've been talking about how economies have to adjust to a new financial reality. The question, it's easy to say that, well, we must adjust to a new financial reality, we must reduce consumption, increase production, we must reduce government spending, we must increase so on and so forth. The real question, the political question, the real world question that everybody in Europe and North America faces is, who's going to pay the price? Right. And as I'm sure you all know, there are massive differences over who should pay the price. We can see it very easily in Europe. In Europe, the heterogeneity of interests, of preferences, tends to track geography, right? That is, Greeks versus Germans and things along those lines. But this is a common of all debt crises. Every debt crisis that I know of, and I've studied dozens, maybe hundreds over the years, and others have as well, raises questions about the distribution of the adjustment burden. There are typically two dimensions, by the way. The first dimension is across countries. So you have creditor countries and debtor countries with very different interests. The creditor countries want to get paid back, and the debtor countries want to pay as little as possible. We see that in Europe, where the Germans want to get paid back and the Greeks want to pay as little as possible. That's understandable. But there's also a conflict within countries. Because within Germany, there's a question, just to stay on that particular example, within Germany there's a question as to whether it will be the banks that will take the hit or the German taxpayers. Within Greece, there's a question as to whether it will be government employees, whether it will be taxpayers, whether it will be the private sector, the public sector. In every debt crisis, there are many dimensions of conflict over who will pay the price. There are, we should note, powerful incentives to settle these crises, but there are, in some sense, equally powerful incentives to make sure that they're settled on terms that are most favorable to you, which is why many debt crises, like the current European one, start to take on the very depressing picture of a game of chicken, as both sides wait to try to outfox the other. It's been very striking, I think, that discussion of these issues in the U.S. has been so polarized. So I want to take a moment to talk a bit, think a bit, as to why the aftermath of this crisis, much more, I mean, think back, those of you who are older than Matthias, think back to previous American recessions, and think back to the debates over those recessions. None of them have the extraordinarily polarized character of the discussion of this particular crisis. You have to go back to the 1930s to find anything even remotely similar. And so why is that? Why is it that the debate has been so polarized? Why is it that we have really something close to political gridlock? I think to understand this, we have to recognize the great heterogeneity of the impact of the crisis on different groups in American society. Now, there's a backdrop to this that many of you know, and that is the overriding social reality of the U.S. in the last 40 years is that since the early 1970s, the U.S. has become more unequal. And I'm not taking a position on this. This is just an expression of a long-standing and well-known social trend in the U.S. There really are two moments in that, by the way. The first is from the early 70s until the mid-80s, when the bottom falls out of the labor market and unskilled and semi-skilled American workers find their real and in some cases absolute wages declining. The lowest paid 25% of American workers. So that's the first moment of that deterioration in the American income distribution is that period. But then starting in the early 90s, there's a separate process, or I don't know if it's separate, but a different process. And that's a process whereby the top 10% starts separating from the middle class. So in the first period, you have the bottom 25 or so percent really losing out. In the second period, you have the top 10% separating from the rest of society. I should note, just parenthetically, since we are talking about international issues as well, is that much of the popular discussion of this, scholarly as well, but popular discussion of this, at least alludes to there being international sources of both these trends. So a lot of people believe that the reason, or one of the reasons, or a major reason, why the real wage of unskilled American workers dropped in those first 10 or 12 years was due to increased competition from low-wage workers in Asia. My colleague Rich Freeman in the economics department at Harvard has a famous article called "Are Your Wages Set in Beijing?" in which he points out that bringing 2 billion unskilled, low-wage Asian workers into the world's labor market must have put downward pressure on the wages of unskilled American workers who are producing, in many instances, similar goods. The second moment, that top 10% separating from the middle class, is often associated with what people talk about as the headquarters society, the emergence of the U.S. as a headquarters society, because that 10% is disproportionately in multinational corporations, international banks, their accountants, their lawyers, their people in high tech, their people who are engaged in economic activities that are associated with American banks, corporations, institutions that play a massive role in the global economy and have been very, very successful at doing that, right? So that's the backdrop. Some of you will know that that Raghurajan, the former chief economist at the World Bank and an excellent finance economist at Chicago Booth, has written a book called Fault Lines, in which he essentially ascribes the crisis to this deterioration in income distribution. His argument is the income distribution was deteriorating. The Bush administration did not want to undertake active redistributive measures, and so it encouraged people in the middle and lower middle classes to borrow, and that's really the source of the crisis. I think there's a kernel of truth in that. I don't think that's the entirety of the story, but that's his story, and I want to give credit to it. Because it's important to recognize that the debt finance consumption of the 2001 to 2007 period did in fact mitigate, in fact, stop the deterioration of this income distribution as people's incomes rise. But even in that period of expansion, of growth, the distribution of the growth was highly unequal. Right? Two-thirds of the income growth realized between 2002 and 2007 went to the top 1% of the U.S. Of the U.S. economy, the top 1% of households. I hate to use that 1%, but that's where the data come from, not to take a partisan position. But so if you look at that top 1%, which is households earning about $400,000 and above, that top 1% of American households in those 7 years saw their income rise by 60%. For the remainder of the U.S. economy, the other 99% of households, their income rose 6% in those 7 years. And all of that increase was wiped out by the recession that ensued. So there was even heterogeneity in the good times. But there was a lot more heterogeneity, a lot more differences among groups in society during the crisis. Probably the easiest way of seeing this is by looking at the incidence of unemployment. I mean, the biggest impact, unemployment is, I think, almost all analysts would agree that the biggest real cost of a crisis like this is unemployment, because these are resources that could be used for productive purposes, and they're not. Long-term unemployment often feeds on itself. People who are out of work for 2 or 3 years often drop out of the labor market, become de-skilled, discouraged workers, things like that. So unemployment is crucially important. And the distribution of unemployment was extraordinarily unequal in this crisis, much more unequal than in previous recessions. Example, at the trough, the unemployment rate in the country as a whole was about 10%. To be 9.9, to be perfectly accurate, right? But now let's divide the labor market in thirds. Think of the top third, middle third, bottom third of the labor market. Each third, by the way, is a lot of people. So if you include, let's start with the bottom third. If you include the workers, their families, their dependents, you're talking about 100 million people, right? So when the unemployment rate was 9.9% for the country as a whole, for the bottom third of the labor market, it was 18%. Now, if we add on, as I think we should, what's sometimes called underemployment, that's made up of two groups of people. One is workers who would like to work full-time but cannot find full-time work and are therefore forced to work part-time. And as you know, in the United States, if you're working part-time, the chances are you're not getting health insurance, you're not getting a whole series of benefits, you may not even be getting unemployment, be eligible for unemployment benefits, etc. So these are involuntary part-time workers. And the second group is so-called discouraged workers, that is, people who have been out of work for 2 years or more and have dropped out of the labor market. Okay. So if you add the underemployed to the employed in this context, in that bottom third of the labor market, the unemployed plus underemployment rate rises to 38%, which is practically depression, is really depression levels. Now look at the top third of the labor market. Top third of the labor market is households earning approximately 80,000 and up. In that top third, when the national unemployment rate is about 10%, and it's 18% in the bottom third. In the top third, the unemployment rate is 4%. If you add the underemployment rate, it rises to 8%. Now, both of those numbers are about double where they are in normal times, but they're nowhere near the crisis levels represented in the bottom third of the labor market. So if you think about that kind of heterogeneity, you can understand, I think, why some Americans think the government should be doing a whole lot more, and other Americans think it should be doing less. And those who think it should be doing less in the upper third might well be saying to themselves, this is not that severe a crisis. If the government is spending all this money and running all these deficits, we're going to pay for it because we're the taxpayers. I mean, it's the top third that pays most of the taxes. So why should we be incurring these trillions of dollars in deficits to deal with a crisis that really is not having that big an impact on us when we're going to end up paying the price? Right. So to me, this helps explain why there has been such resistance to and why there is such polarization in the response to the crisis and its aftermath. The top third, in some sense, of the American labor market is in a mild or has been in a mild state of difficulty, while the bottom third is in a very, very severe crisis, and a crisis which may last for a lot longer because of the de-skilling nature of structural unemployment and the length that these unemployment spells have taken. Now, this polarization, this heterogeneity, is, of course, not uniquely American. Conflict over who will pay is rife in every debt crisis, both within nations and across nations. In Europe, again, it takes this geographic thing. There's an interesting question here that interesting to academics like me, at least, which is why the differences in the U.S. very rarely take on regional characteristics. Because I live in Boston. The unemployment rate in Boston is 5%. Right? We never got above about 6.5% or 7%. Housing prices in Boston dropped about 5% from their peak. They're now well above their peak. Boston really didn't suffer. At the time, at the worst of the crisis, the unemployment rate in Nevada was almost 20%. Now it's still in double digits. Right? We have, I think, I don't remember the exact figures. I think something like 5% of mortgages in all of Massachusetts are underwater. Two-thirds of mortgages in Nevada are underwater, which the notion of Nevada being underwater is sort of strange. But anyway, two-thirds of the mortgages in Nevada are underwater. So if this were Europe, we might have my fellow Massachusetts Bay Staters is the word, my fellow Bay Staters saying, why should we be wasting our money to bail out a bunch of lazy Nevadans and Arizonans and Californians and Carolinians and Floridians? But we don't. We don't have that kind of geographical distinction, which I think is an interesting analytical question. Why there is so little geographic distinction in the U.S. over this. I think the standard answer, which Matthias probably would give, is there's a certain sense of social solidarity among Americans that Europeans don't share. Right? But nonetheless, whether in Europe or in North America, there is a clear sense that some people have done particularly poorly and are not being helped by and are not working their way out of this crisis, and others are doing reasonably well, and there are massive disagreements over what should be done to deal with the crisis. All of this reminds me, by the way, and one of the most difficult aspects of a debt crisis is that typically, and I've given you some examples from the American context, typically the people who do the best when the borrowing is going on are not those who are being asked to make the biggest sacrifices when the crisis hits. Right? I mean, it reminds me of an experience in 1985 in Brazil. I was in Brazil in 1985. I think that was after you were born, Matthias. You were 5 years old. I'm never going to let you forget that. So I was in Brazil in 1985, during their very severe debt crisis. They still had a military dictatorship, military government, and the military president of Brazil went on television to make a very important speech in the context of a new round of austerity measures. And he said, famously, Brazilians have to understand that the party is over. And the next day, on the streets of Rio and São Paulo, there were massive demonstrations, and the banners all read, "The party's over, and we weren't even invited." Right? And that's the feeling a lot of people have. And even in a Greece, I can guarantee you, I know for certain, that there are people in Greece who say, everybody talks about how well off we were during this borrowing period, but it wasn't me. And now they're telling me I have to take a 20% cut in pay because some bureaucrat was dipping into the till. Right. So it's a lot of the political polarization has to do with the perception of unfairness, that the sacrifices being demanded are not equiproportional to the benefits that were realized during the borrowing boom. Okay. So I'm going to end this discussion of the crisis by saying, cryptically perhaps, in my view, there are some fairly straightforward economic policy measures that could be undertaken that would help alleviate the effects of this crisis in both the short term and the medium term and the long term. And the reason I'm not going to talk about that right now is because we're in a political campaign, and I'm absolutely sure that over the course of the next 2 months we will hear a whole series of constructive, rational, well-designed economic policy suggestions that will tell us exactly how we can get out of this crisis in a way that is bipartisan, doesn't raise issues, and is accepted by... No. So you're also cynical. The reason I'm not going to talk about it is because we can talk about that in Q&A or in the discussion. I do think that if you got 100 of the country's best macroeconomists in a room, they could relatively easily arrive at a consensus as to what could and should be done in the short, medium, and long run, at least within some range. It would probably not be politically feasible, but they could come up with the measures. So we can talk about that. But rather than go there, I want to ask a different question, or raise a different question, a question that's in some sense more academic, more the kind of thing that scholars would ask, but also relevant, I think, to everyone, because it suggests that to some extent we are in a new environment. After all, this is the first time in the modern world economy in which a very large number of rich countries have fallen into a coordinated debt crisis. Right? Debt crises used to be things that Turkey's and Brazil's and Thailand's had. These are debt crises in rich countries. This is the first time in which we have a coordinated crisis of this type in rich countries in modern times. There may have been some examples. We could point to some examples from the 19th century, perhaps. Right. And it is the first crisis of this type, right, again, since the 1930s. So I want to really ask a question going back to the source. Why did all this happen? So far I've talked about the proximate causes. I've talked about the borrowing boom. I've talked about fiscal policy in the U.S. I've talked about the Eurozone. But I think, in some sense, we want to push things back a step and say, okay, the proximate cause was a set of policies which in retrospect were very misguided. But why was policy so misguided? Not for lack of good economists. Not for lack of good advice. And here I feel constrained to sort of say something that may sound a little bit self-justifying, not for me personally, but for academics. And it involves disagreeing with QE, not quantitative easing, but Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth, you may recall, about 9 months ago, was speaking to a group of British economists and said, "Why did none of you warn us about this?" And that became sort of the common understanding, which is this crisis took place and no one, no economist, no analyst had anticipated that there might be a crisis of this type. And I'm here to tell you that that is absolutely incorrect. That for 5 years before the crisis hit, virtually every meeting I went to of people working in international macroeconomics focused on what at that point was called the global macroeconomic imbalances. And the only question that people asked at that point was whether there would be a hard landing or a soft landing. Previn remembers these meetings. Now, it's true that people did not say there will be a crisis that begins in the subprime portion of the American mortgage market and is then transmitted through Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and AIG. Right. So people didn't anticipate what exactly how the crisis would take place, but that's not really what modern economics or social science can do. What the analysts, political scientists, the political economists, the economists were saying for 5 years before 2008 was there are tensions building up in the global macroeconomy which are of grave concern and which are very likely to cause serious difficulties. And yet, policymakers did not respond. Okay? So, why? Why does such a thing happen? Now, there's an easy answer here, which is for policymakers, it's always, you know, the long term is the next election, right? And, you know, 5 years is an eternity in political terms, so worrying about something that might happen in 5 years is really just not done. But I think that's too simple, because after all, if you look at the Bush administration paid a terrible, or the Republican Party, not Bush itself, the Republican Party paid a terrible price for having presided over the recession that began at the end of 2007. So it's hard to believe that it really is in the interest of policymakers to avoid or ignore these kinds of signals. Well, I don't have an answer to this question, but I want to suggest something. I want to suggest that the environment that policy is currently being made in is different in important ways from the environment within which policy has been made or had been made for the previous 50 or 60 years since World War II. That there have been some very fundamental changes that affect the way economic policy is made. Changes in the opportunities available to policymakers, to governments, and changes in the constraints they face. First, the opportunities. The big news is we have a global capital market. We have a virtually limitless pool of financial capital, which can be lent out at very low cost, at very high speed, in enormous quantities. And that, it's not new because some people would say it existed before 1914, but in the modern world, it's new. I remember in 1981, when I was a graduate student, the Reagan deficits started to emerge. The discussion was all about how these deficits were going to crowd out private investment in the U.S. because that's what people were used to. If the government has to borrow $200 billion, that money's not available for the private sector. But that's not what happened. Instead of the government borrowing $200 billion and reducing funds available to the rest of the economy, it borrowed $200 billion from the rest of the world. In 2001 to 2007, when the Bush administration, when the U.S. government or the Greek government or other governments ran fiscal deficits, they borrowed it from the rest of the world. So there is a virtually limitless international financial market that presents opportunities for policymakers to borrow if that's what they want to do. So that's one big change. The other changes are on the constraints on policy. First constraint, the effective loss of monetary policy in different ways. Before the 1980s, monetary and fiscal policy were the two legs upon which macroeconomic policy stood. And national governments typically had active monetary policy, whether exchange rate policy or monetary policy more generally, and used it for macroeconomic stabilization to try to stimulate the economy. And then you had the Volcker shock of 1979 and what came to be called the Great Moderation. And over the course of the 1980s, essentially in advanced industrial countries and even in most developing countries, monetary policy was removed as an instrument of economic policy, with the understanding that low inflation was desirable, that there were major risks in using monetary policy which could lead to inflation or even hyperinflation in developing countries, to the extent that in Europe, monetary policy was actually eliminated from all but the European Central Bank. So in the U.S., the U.S. government committed itself to a very low inflation target and therefore, in a sense, gave up monetary policy as an instrument of macroeconomic stabilization and adjustment, more stimulus. And in Europe, national governments gave up monetary policy by joining the Eurozone. Well, countries used monetary policy to respond to political pressures. Those political pressures didn't go away. So one big change is, as governments gave up monetary policy, they're under substantially more pressure to use fiscal policy to try to stimulate the economy. To put it somewhat differently, if you have two instruments to try to stimulate the economy, one is monetary policy and one is fiscal policy. You lose monetary policy, you put more emphasis on fiscal policy. And now you've got a limitless supply of funds that you can use to borrow from. So countries can respond to the loss of monetary policy by running expansionary fiscal policies. This was expressed to me in 1989. I talked to after the Italians joined the European monetary system and so tied the lira to the Deutschmark and gave up their own monetary policy, the head of Confindustria, which is the Italian industry association, said, yeah, it's true that when we linked to the Deutschmark and gave up monetary policy, we lost 1.5 million jobs in industry, but that's all right. We gained them in the public sector. Right? So by giving up monetary policy, you lost 1.5 million industrial jobs, but then the government ran, 5, 6, 7% of GDP deficits by borrowing from the rest of the world so that they could pick up the slack politically. So governments found that they could respond to these political demands by engaging in deficit spending, as the U.S., the U.K., and some other governments did. The second pressure that governments responded to, and I recognize that I'm running out of time, moving quickly towards the end. The second constraint is the stagnation of middle-income consumption. Now, this takes different forms in different countries. In the U.S., it's what I was talking about, the income distribution. In Europe, different European countries, it takes different forms. In some cases, it's structural youth unemployment. It's a stagnation of middle-income employment, a stagnation of middle-income growth in European countries. But throughout most of the OECD, throughout most of the developed world, over the course of the 1990s, there was a common experience that incomes of middle-income, that the standards of living of middle-income residents were stagnant or in some cases declining. Right? And again, it was easy for governments to say, well, if those incomes are declining, one way of responding is by giving our residents access to this limitless pool of capital, which will allow them to borrow their way towards higher levels of consumption. Right? I had a colleague who at some point when we were talking about this said, yeah, the attitude in the U.S. is, who needs a welfare state when everybody has a credit card? And that was sort of the attitude in many areas of the world to the experience of the 1990s and the last decade. So let me sum up. The general point that I would make about this is that, as with Latin America in the 70s and 80s or East Asia in the 90s, access to more or less unlimited finance can have many, many benefits. I think open capital markets are a very good thing. But they also allow policymakers to take the easy way out in the short run in instances in which borrowing for current consumption, incurring debts in order to engage in current consumption rather than productive investment, is far too easy, or has been far too easy, in ways that eventually lead to the kinds of crises that we've experienced. So that's my quasi-academic interlude there, to try to think about why it is that this particular crisis is so different from previous ones. So let me circle back to where I started, just to say we have experienced, and we are unfortunately still experiencing, a classic debt crisis. A debt crisis born of 10 years of debt finance consumption. A debt crisis in the world's two largest economies, in the U.S. and in the Eurozone. It's hard to imagine that so serious, so all-encompassing a debt crisis could not have devastating effects. These effects, I think, unfortunately, are being exacerbated by the political conflict that has ensued, by the impasse in economic policymaking that both the United States and the European Union find themselves in, by the conflicts that have proliferated both within countries and across countries. The policy challenge, I think, is to address the resolution of this debt crisis in a way that allows us to move forward, right, to leave behind the game of chicken that benefits no one in the long run. The scholarly challenge is to understand how and why this crisis took place so that we can try to avoid something like it in the future. I'll stop there and we can open it up for Q&A. So I don't know anyone's name. I know a few people's names, but I don't know anyone's name, many people's names. So I'll just point at you if you want to talk. Raise your hand. Okay. That.
Jeff, thank you for a beautifully clear presentation with a very plausible analysis and conclusions. I'd like to take you back to the causes of unemployment. You mentioned that it seems plausible, and you talked about the Friedman article, that some of this unemployment problem is associated with globalization, or what we loosely call globalization, competition for jobs where wages are low and productivity is higher than we might think. But isn't it the case that there are also a couple of other explanations? One is for those at the bottom who have not very skilled jobs and not very and a lot of skills, that immigration is a competition, source of competition for those jobs, and that might contribute to some of that kind of unemployment. And thirdly, isn't it the case that we've been in a period of extraordinary innovation, so that those who have high skills will find jobs, but those that don't can't take advantage as well of the new opportunities? So my question to you is, what's the mix here? And which of these things is perhaps most of a concern?
Well, I mean, of course, it varies by country. And the answer in European country, in many European countries, would be very different than what it is in the U.S. And all I can do is give you my impressions based on my reading of the specialist literature. So immigration is a mixed bag, because immigration is mixed. It is, and again, this is not meant to be a partisan political statement, but it's almost certainly the case that unskilled immigration tends to exert downward pressure on the wages of unskilled Americans because they're thrown into competition. However, the mix of skills among immigrants to the U.S. has changed dramatically over the last 20 years. We now have an extraordinarily large number of very highly skilled immigrants, right? And if you go to Silicon Valley, you'll hear complaints about them because there are many in Silicon Valley who say, well, all these Chinese, Korean, Indian, other software engineers are competing with us. So I think that although it is probably true that at the margin some of the unskilled immigration does exert downward pressure, that's a small effect. The trade effect, again, there have been studies of this. The trade effect is usually found to be bigger than the immigration effect because of the mix of immigrants. The second point that you make about skills, I think, is a very important one. I'm not sure how much I would ascribe the current level of unemployment to it, because, of course, you know, the skill mismatch hasn't changed in the last 5 years. We have fairly similar change in technology in 2006 to what we or technology as we do today. But I think there is a medium and long-term problem in the U.S., which is sometimes called the skill mismatch. We have a primary and secondary education system, which in many senses and in many areas is dysfunctional, or at least is not providing the level of skills necessary for a modern economy. It used to be the case that bare literacy was enough for a decent factory job, and that's no longer the case. The college premium, that is the premium, the wage premium associated with even some college, and certainly 4 years of college, has risen dramatically. That's largely associated with computer literacy, and I'm interpreting computer literacy in the broadest sense. What this implies is that unless there are substantial changes in primary and secondary education in the U.S., where we lag very far behind in math and science, there will be an increasing skill mismatch. Now, that's a problem. Like all problems, almost all problems, that's at some level a social problem for the country as a whole, but it's also a distributional problem. That is, there are some groups in the population that have done spectacularly well. I happen to live in a community where the education is fantastic. We don't have a skill mismatch in Boston, right? But the country as a whole does. And as the country, I'll be blunt about this because this was in the papers. I think we are at a point where very soon the majority of primary and secondary school age children would be non-white. And that raises political issues over whether the taxpayers, right, who if you sort of weight them by income are predominantly white, are willing to pay for the education of predominantly non-white children. I mean, that's an incredibly crude way of putting it, but I'm a crude kind of guy. I come from New York, and I saw the process at work. I saw the process at work in neighborhood after neighborhood and suburb after suburb, where as the complexion, so to speak, of the neighborhoods and the suburbs changed, the willingness of the homeowners to pay for high-quality education declined. That, I think, is a formula for disaster. I think unless we come to grips with the fact that as a country, we need high-quality education for the broad population, not just for the kids who happen to live in the affluent suburbs, but for the population as a whole, we are going to have serious structural unemployment problems, serious social problems. I mean, this is a problem, to just take an example that you're well familiar with. This is a problem that the French are now starting to face because they've experienced similar phenomena where there are segments of the population that have been neglected by the educational system and have become marginal to economic activity. And that is not a formula for social, economic, or political progress.
I had a question about the role or the roles of central banks that you mentioned, the sort of two-legged system. Mm-hmm. You were mentioning and describing how one leg has basically fallen off. It's not there anymore since the late 70s, early 80s. I wonder how, in that context, you could explain a particular central bank, like the Bundesbank, for instance, which had a more narrowly defined mandate, even in those years, even in the years preceding mm-hmm. the Great Moderation, and actually fought inflation, or only tried to fight inflation in the 70s, when we and the rest of the world in Europe and in the US were fighting and dealing with stagflation, and whether you can link that to the German model, or whether that actually forces countries to run huge account surpluses or trades, trade surpluses, and whether you can establish some kind of link to what happened today, and whether the European Central Bank is actually trying to reestablish some kind of more proactive role as a central bank.
Right. Well, that's about 12 questions. I'll try to answer at least one of them. So I think you refer to the German system, and I think there's a characteristic of the German strategy, if you want to call it a strategy, whether it was evolved in some, you know, some clever way or just emerged is indifferent. I think it probably just emerged, is that really starting after World War II and continuing up to the present day, the German attitude, very similar to that of Japan, for example, was that economic growth was going to be achieved by restraining wage growth and by restraining the growth of input prices and by stimulating exports. That is, this was sort of an export-led growth model. There is a blip in the late 80s, early 90s with unification that really scared people in Germany. You know, when German unification, without going into details, when German unification gave rise to a whole series of both labor market and fiscal problems in Germany, it led to very systematic attempts to try to make sure that the German system was restored. And by restored means wages were restrained, pushed down, right, and export growth was increased. So the Germans have committed themselves, have long since committed themselves, to an export-led growth model. Now, I'm not sure this is an answer, but I think it's relevant to the question you're asking. That export-led growth model, in the German export-led growth model, is inconsistent with the resolution of the European debt crisis. The only way the European debt crisis can be resolved, I mean, there, I suppose you could, another way would be the Germans could forgive all the debts. But what this process is associated with is the Germans run big surpluses exporting to Spain and Italy and Greece and Ireland and other countries, and lend those countries the money to finance those deficits. Right? At this point, the debts are out there. There is not going to be new lending. The only way, I'll use Spain as the example, the only way Spain's going to be able to repay these debts is by running surpluses with Germany. That is, with Germany running deficits. And that is inconsistent with the German model. Now, so what you would expect, I mean, this, again, without being too stylized, what you would expect in a simple textbook picture is rebalancing means German labor costs have to rise, German consumption has to rise, German unit labor costs have to rise, German prices have to rise as they run a deficit, and Spanish labor costs go down, unit labor costs go down, Spanish prices go down. Spanish unit labor costs have gone down. Irish have gone down 15%, Spanish 7 or 8%, I think. German unit labor costs have also gone down. So the Germans, in fact, are not rebalancing. The Germans are not changing their strategy in this context, which raises a real question for whether the German political economy is in a position to accept the net measures necessary to deal with the crisis. All right. I think that's the second component part of your question. The third is the ECB. There's a lot of evidence that the issues faced by countries like Spain and Portugal and other southern European countries are not just about intra-European trade, but also extra-European trade. The euro, by most accounts, is too strong for the economic conditions that exist in much of the eurozone, including in the peripheral European countries. So I think there are those who argue that a much weaker euro would help resolve the crisis, especially in the periphery. There's a problem with that view, and that view is probably correct. The problem with that view is that there are people in the United States who think that one of the ways that the United States should resolve its problem is by having a weaker dollar. And there are people in China who think that the way out of their problems is to have a weaker renminbi. And there are people in Brazil who think the way out of their problems is to have a weaker real. And people in Japan who think the way out of their problems is to have a weaker... Not all countries can devalue at the same time. And so there is, I think, we haven't really talked about this, but there really is the risk of what Guido Mantegna, the economics minister of Brazil, talked about a few months ago of being currency wars, right? I mean, one of the easiest ways of dealing with these kinds of economic problems is by driving your currency down and increasing your exports to the rest of the world. The Germans would prefer not to rebalance within Europe, and I think given the choice, they'd rather have a weak euro. German exporters certainly would. But you can't have a weak euro if the dollar is also weakening. So I think this raises serious problems. And let me emphasize what I think I said before, what I hope transmitted before, is none of these problems are technically difficult. That is, one can find technical economic ways forward, which involve renegotiating and restructuring debts, working out collaborative fiscal and monetary policies. There are all sorts of, we could sit down tomorrow, I don't know about you, but someone could sit down tomorrow and come up with perfectly reasonable resolutions to many of these problems. The question is not whether they're technically feasible, it's whether they're politically feasible. And I have to say that I'm worried because I don't see a lot of the political will in the major financial centers to get off the chicken game and sit down and work out some really serious collaborative measures. Eric, I know your name.
That was a great talk, Jeff. Thanks very much. I have a real quick question. I mean, it seems like you sketch a narrative where we get financial market integration creates moral hazard, leads to abuse, ends up in some kind of a crisis, and then we have a distributive conflict over the adjustment. Now, is this cycle inevitable? Is this an inevitable cost of financial market integration? Because you said at the end of your talk that you think financial market integration is a good thing. Is there any way we can lower the price of it?
I don't think it's inevitable. It is in some way the $64 trillion question. I don't think it's inevitable. I think Eric, I did a lot of work on the 19th century, and there are many similarities between the experiences of the 19th and early 20th century and today. It took a long time and many, many defaults and many, many panics for international financial markets, for borrowers, for lenders, for governments to figure out that there were reasons to constrain borrowing, that there was such a thing as productive and constructive international borrowing or international lending, and unproductive and unconstructive. I think a starting point would be to recognize, and this gets back to the question about, I hate to pick on Germany, but it does get back to this question about Germany. It does imply getting away from this kind of moralistic view that says the world is divided into irresponsible, lazy borrowers and responsible, hardworking lenders. Because in my view, I don't know what's worse, borrowing irresponsibly or lending irresponsibly. I mean, the Germans lent irresponsibly. And yes, it's true. The U.S. and the peripheral Europeans borrowed irresponsibly. So there's plenty of irresponsibility to go around. But people, I'm enough of an optimist to think that people and even politicians learn from their mistakes, that there are ways of structuring both governments and international institutions to try to avoid falling into these crises. After all, I mean, again, an exemplar of what I would have in mind is the I think, generally speaking, positive experience of many Latin American countries in the aftermath of the 1980s debt crisis. If you had asked someone in 1987 whether Latin America was going to be a paragon of economic virtue, they would have laughed at you. But the fact is that on many dimensions, not all of Latin America, on many dimensions, it is. On many dimensions, Latin American countries have very, very sensible economic policies and have, in some cases, like Chile, been laboratories for economic policies that could use application elsewhere, including in the U.S. and Western Europe. So I do think that governments, policymakers, and others learn from mistakes, and I do think that it's not inevitable that these crises take place. Ragnar Nirksi, in the late 1940s, said, we found, in countries found, in the pre-1930 period, that international finance was like an umbrella that was given to you when the weather was good and taken away as soon as it started to rain. Right? And that's a lesson that people have to learn, that you cannot rely on continued access to international financial markets to solve all your problems. One more question there, I guess. One more, two.
I think I followed along with everything you said, and there was a lot there. But just to try and tie it down and see if I did follow along, let me pose a simple question this way. Let's say that you were put in charge of Greece and that you had full authority to, you know, sort of like the guy in Italy. You know, you could do what you wanted, but your goal was to do what was the best for sort of in a nationalistic way for the Greek people. Now, just put together everything you said. Now, what would you do if in that? Now, you can't control what the Germans are going to do and so on. But what would you do if you were put in charge of Greece?
That's a perfectly reasonable question, and one could ask the same thing about the U.S., I suppose. I think I'll give you a simple answer, and then I'll expand on it a little bit. I would insist on a substantial restructuring of the Greek debt, and I would insist on a substantial restructuring of Greek finances and the imposition of medium to long-term austerity measures, not short-term because that's counterproductive, right? And the restructuring of the debt is because it's clear that these debts are not going to be serviced as contracted. And pretending that the debts are going to be paid is actually counterproductive. It prolongs the agony. We found that out in the savings and loan crisis. Now, people remember the savings and loan crisis. He doesn't remember. Some people remember the savings and loan. You're never going to forget this. The savings and loan crisis of the 1980s, when the CBO originally identified the savings and loan crisis, which had a lot of similarities with what we're going through today, although on a much, much smaller scale, it estimated the cost of resolution at about $3 or $4 billion. Congress and the president waffled and delayed because they didn't want to put banks out of business. They had constituents that were at threat and so on and so forth. It didn't get resolved until 1989 when finally they had no choice, and it cost $130 billion. So pretending that unpayable debts are payable is not costless. And so I think a radical restructuring of the debt, but you have to associate that with the radical attack on the dysfunctionality of Greek public finances and of the Greek public sector. The parenthesis I would open and say is, you know, what does that say about the U.S.? In the U.S., we have a problem which is a little bit different. Most the debts that matter in the U.S., and Spain is in a similar position, are not public debts. They're private debts. They're household debts. We have probably 30 million American mortgages that need to be restructured. You can't restructure 30 million mortgages the way you can restructure one national government's debt. So the challenge for the U.S. is how do we undertake economic policies that change the character of the debt, that reduce the debt burden in a way that makes it more manageable and allows the economy to start growing again. And I'm going to be controversial here. I can do it because I've already done it in print with Menzi in a couple of articles, and say, and also controversial, but Ken Rogoff, so Ken Rogoff is a conservative Republican, advisor to the Republican campaign, so this is not a partisan political statement, and he has said exactly the same thing, that the easiest way, the most desirable way to deal with the debt overhang in the U.S., which is almost entirely on the private side, private household debt side, is to run moderate inflation in the 3-5% range for 3 or 4 years. That leads to a dramatic reduction in the real debt burden, and that reduces the debt overhang. That is not a popular thing to say, but I think if you have to recognize where the problem lies, we have a number of bad choices, and I think that's the least bad of the choices available to us. Can we take one more question? One more question. You know, I could talk forever, you know.
Doug Miller, I'm a first-year student, so I apologize for the casual clothing.
That's all right.
Enjoying being a student again. This is a less of an economic question, kind of starts with your point of deadlock in Congress and ends with just overall communication. But I see kind of more of a rising problem. You know, you brought up Massachusetts and Nevada. You don't see solidarity among states being American. But you see less of I see a larger problem in more of self-segregation, where people enjoy talking amongst themselves, mostly with people that they agree with. You know, I tend to be a believer that if two people are discussing a topic and agree 100%, you know, one of them is not necessary. That being said, kind of concluding, to get through a problem, you know, everybody needs to discuss it. And outside of the academic circle, you don't really see that a whole lot. And I was just, you know, more so for your comment, where you see in the U.S. where we stand and you know, where you go.
Well, I'd have to be honest and say that at some level I'm somewhat pessimistic, recognizing, of course, that a pessimist is just a well-informed optimist. The track record of the last 10 years is not a good one. There are two aspects of this that I think are worth pointing to that the academic literature has identified. To an extent much greater than was the case 30 years ago, people get their news from outlets that they agree with. Right. So because of the internet, because of the not disappearance, because of the decline of daily newspapers, so you know, you have almost no three or four newspaper towns left anymore, because of cable television and things like that, people have a wide selection of, to be blunt, biased news sources, and people tend to watch news sources whose biases are in line with their own. If you're on the left, you watch MSNBC. If you're on the right, you watch Fox. If you're on the left, you read, I don't know what you read, but, you know, you read blogs that you agree with, you know, and on your right, you read blogs that you agree with. So, and that's not conducive to finding resolutions to problems. So that's one source of polarization that I observe. A second source is political. Actually, there's been some very interesting academic work among political scientists on this. Let me summarize it. That most of the survey evidence indicates that Americans remain relatively centrist. The extremes have gotten more extreme. That is, that especially on the right. The right wing of the Republican Party is more extreme than it was 20 years ago in most of its views. Left wing of the Democratic Party is also extreme. But the average American, both the median and the average, is quite moderate. Right? So where is this polarization coming from, political scientists ask. And when they ask those kinds of questions, what they see is that you see a polarization in Congress that you don't see in the electorate. Right? The political parties are much more polarized than their bases, than their electorates are. The usual explanation that's given is that a lot of this is taken back to 1994, when you had a Democratic president and then the Republicans took the House. And the Republicans felt the only way they were going to have any influence over economic policy was by having a unified party. And that meant that there was a premium placed on having party unity. Party unity is, you know, typically has not been the norm in American politics. It's the norm in European politics. But, you know, having all the Democrats vote for one bill, all the Republicans vote on the other side, that's unusual in the U.S., or it was unusual. But starting in the mid-90s, it became the norm. And so as you got these more and more centralized parties, you then had the problem that the parties, if you have a centralized party, the party base, the activists, have disproportionate influence. And the activists tend to be towards the extremes. So the activists in the Democratic Party are towards the left, and the activists in the Republican Party are towards the right. So those two processes, where the parties are much more unified and where the activists have increased influence, is what political scientists usually ascribe to this polarization in Congress. So that's just a little bit of background. What are the implications, and where, and might we move forward? I hate to say it, but, you know, much of the historical and contemporary evidence is that when you're dealing with problems of this severity, a chicken game of this kind of sort, it takes a real exacerbation of the crisis for people to be forced into compromise. Right? There's talk now about the fiscal cliff that we're approaching. There's even talk, I mean, it used to be 6 months ago, everybody's saying, oh, well, they'll never go over the fiscal cliff. It's just too dramatic and too radical. Now that discussion has changed. At this point, people are saying, well, from either standpoint, the fiscal cliff is better for the Republicans than any compromise they could work out with the Democrats. The fiscal cliff is better for the Democrats than any compromise they could work out with the Republicans. The chances are we may go over that fiscal cliff. If we do, I think things will continue to get worse. We'll probably have another recession. If that happens, I mean, we may continue to spiral down. So I mean, this is not a happy picture that I'm drawing, but I think that if we're trying to figure out a way forward, that either people are going to have to force their elected representatives to try to come to some consensual compromise position on issues on which the technical problems are really not that severe, or the crisis is going to have to get severe enough that they have no choice but to come to some consensual compromise. And on that happy note,
let me just end on a note. When I first met Jeff Friedan, I believe it was a year and a half ago in Berlin, and I was terrified because I was going to be on a panel with him, and this was Jeff Friedan. I had read all his stuff, and I was terrified of being crazy or stupid or say anything, and him like coming after me. So I asked the chair of the panel if I could go first, which is actually is good advice to, you know, young academics, because then at least you don't have to react to anybody. People will hopefully react to you, and at least you'll get some attention. And so Jeff came right after me, and I was terrified what he was going to say. And he said, everything I wanted to say, Matthias has just said. So I'm just going to talk about American foreign policy, something I haven't prepared, and I have loved him ever since. And it's only for that reason that I remarked on your youthful age. I think I was getting old when my freshmen at American University last year were born in 1994. So at least at size, nobody's born in the 90s yet. I don't think of our students. So two more things. This book, as you already know, if you've seen, is for sale up front for, I believe, $19. It's just out. I think you can't even get it on Amazon in paperback. It's at late September. And Jeff has kindly agreed to sign them right there. And also there is a reception sponsored by the Schwartz Globalization Initiative next door. So you can either enter it through that door or via the book sales. Thank you all so much for coming, and I will keep you posted on the next events.